Welcome, action fans, and thanks for joining us for another edition of All 90s Action All the Time, as we continue our journey through the 90s filmography of Kurt Russell. I'm one of your hosts, Scott Murphy, and on today's podcast, we're going to be talking about 1993's Tombstone. And who do I mean by we? Well, of course, I mean my regular co-host who is back after his 1 week break from the show. It is screenwriter, one third of Bloodhound Picks, and the hardest drinking gunslinger in all of Michigan. It's Mr. Craig Draheim.
I'm your huckleberry.
And I knew you were going to pick that one.
Yeah.
But that's not all, as we also have a very special guest in the form of the £1 Movie Podcast host, Mr. Wayne Saunders. Hi, Wayne.
Hello, hello. Totally stole my thunder there, Craig. I was going to use exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I thought about finding a different one, but I was going through all my notes. Like, okay, which one actually works with it?
Yeah, I'm your huckleberry is the one that just like fits in the most. But then, I mean, like, it does just make it sound like you're both wanting to get into a fight with me, which is,
yeah. You know. I'm not here to fight. I'm a lover, not a fighter.
Yeah.
Excellent. Good to know. So a little bit of background detail as always. Tombstone was released on Christmas Day in 1993. And now normally I would say who directed the film. But it's going to be easier to first say who wrote the film. So the film was written by the late Kevin Jarr, who also's notable credits include the likes of Glory, The Devil's Own, and Judgment Night. The film was also originally going to be directed by Mr. Jarr, but he was fired after a month of filming as the film just went way behind schedule and apparently he pissed everybody off because he was sticking far too rigidly to his script, which was, according to most people, somewhat overlong. And yes, it just wasn't going well. And also he wanted to shoot entirely in order and have all the same pacing as a 1940s Western. It just, there was a lot of clashing of heads. So he was replaced by the late George Cosmatos, whose most notable credits include the likes of Rambo First Blood Part 2 and Cobra. However, while he is the credited director on the film, it turns out, like, after his death, it came about that really Kurt Russell did a lot of the directing and gave Cosmatos a shot list each morning before going on to set. So he was the kind of secret director, and this has been backed up by other sources, including Val Kilmer. So it's very complicated. Review-wise, Tombstone is currently sitting on a 7.8 out of 10 on IMDb, which is the highest IMDb rating of any film we have covered so far on the show, and will probably be the highest for a while. It is 74% on Rotten Tomatoes, based on 46 reviews. It is 50 on Metacritic, based on 22 reviews, and it has a 3.8 on Letterboxd. Finally, box office-wise, it made $56.5 million off of a $25 million budget, which is pretty solid, but not amazing. However, it was a much, much bigger hit on VHS and has grown into a real kind of cult classic over the years, and some even consider it one of the best Westerns ever made. So, we'll go to you first, Wayne. What is your relationship to Tombstone?
Right, okay, so I saw this, I think it'd be about 1996 would be the first time I saw this. I was 13 when this came out, so 1993. 96 was the first time I saw this. I saw it around a friend's house, and I'm so old that we still had video shops, VHS video shops, back in 1996. And we rented it from, it's called Bill's, that's what the video shop was called, I remember it. And we watched it, and I think we watched it like three times over that weekend. And then the friend in question just went bananas, and every time I saw him, we ended up watching Tombstone. So, and he like watched it constantly. It was one; it's his favourite film easily. So that's sort of my relationship. I loved it from the first time I saw it. I think it's a great film.
And yourself, Craig?
Yeah. So, you know, we were kind of mentioning it before. So Tombstone over here, I can't remember the first time I watched it, but I know I think it was right after it came out on VHS. My dad must have rented it for my grandfather, who was a big Western fan or whatever, which, you know, it was one of those things, if you're a man in the United States for a period of time, it's like you had to love Westerns.
That's not a United States thing. That's like a global thing, I feel that is.
Okay. Well,
my granddad was exactly the same. So.
Yeah, it's just this love of Westerns. And
I feel like over here, when the war movie is more war movies than Westerns, no?
I suppose it depends, because my granddad was, he was 86, like, when he died, which was like 15, 16 years ago. Uh-huh. So I think he sort of grew up with the Westerns rather than the war films. But yeah, either way, any genre that begins with a W, and your granddad loves it. Yeah.
Fair point. Sorry for interrupting.
Oh, Craig. No, I'm glad, because that stuff, I kind of talked about again before we started recording, but I wanted to hear more. I really wanted to hear from both of your perspectives on it, because I saw it, and Tombstone is just one of those movies that it's like, you know, a big, huge classic over here that, I was saying that pretty much it's probably on TV right now. At any point, you could probably find Tombstone playing somewhere on television, and it's just constant. And, you know, the I'm Your Huckleberry is, you know, a big line. And yeah, so I've seen it. I mean, I own it. I don't even know how many times I've seen it now, but I've either seen it its entirety or, you know, at least caught clips of it on television at least tons of times throughout the years. And I even probably watched it a few months ago in that same way. But yeah, it was interesting going on to it now, because I love it. I still love Val Kilmer in it. But for the sake of this podcast, where we're kind of going these scene by scenes, I could see some issues, and there are points for me that it's starting to feel, you know, it dives into that melodrama a lot that there was, especially with the romantic relationship and stuff like that, but which we'll get into. But yeah,
I need to backtrack. I said great film. It's not. It's got flaws. Let's be honest. Yeah. It's got flaws.
But I think, yeah, definitely. But I agree with you, Wayne, though. Definitely watching it for the sake, I think, of entertainment, or like if we were just sitting at home watching it by ourselves, it's, you know, it's really fun and it's entertaining. It's great. And that's it. But yeah, going, I think, for the sake of this, of like the scene by scene kind of element, just like with Copland or other ones that we've had in this series, you know, little things start coming to the surface when you have to really sit down and write notes on it.
Yeah. I think like one of the, actually, you know, talking about the film's reputation, I think one of the things that most surprised me when kind of researching the film was that I had it in my head that most people thought of this as a classic. And then, so it surprised me that the reviews at the time were good, but not great. Because I thought it was just kind of immediately like, you know, it was seen as one of those best Westerns of the 90s, you know, kind of tied with Unforgiven, that kind of thing. But like the reviews seemed to be like solidly thumbs up, but like more in the kind of 3-star kind of bracket, I would say, some 4 stars, but not like not a lot of kind of like, this is great, like 5 stars.
Yeah.
It's a funny one, really, because obviously you just mentioned Unforgiven, and this is surfing that entire, you know, you get somebody like Clint Eastwood behind the lens filming Unforgiven, which is this completely anti-hero Western film. And then off the back of that, you know, Kevin Jarre, like you say, and Kurt Russell and all the cast, they go and make a traditional Western off the back of this. And I think that's sort of where it becomes, where the classic element comes into it, because it is going to an original sort of, this is a film you could have gone and took your granddad to see.
Yeah.
The pictures, you could have shared that, you know, shared experience with them in the cinema. And I think that's, it's almost like a future nostalgia for it. You know, it's a film that's I mean, it's a modern classic, I suppose, a modern Western classic, even though it's not set up today. Yeah.
Yeah, because there are so many moments, especially, and it's in my notes, up until, I don't even know the time, lost track of the time for it, but the whole first, I'd say, 30 minutes feel very much like a old school Western, especially how they talk and they're like, you know, it's kind of this element of, oh, there goes Wyatt doing that crazy thing. And, you know, they're like, and they're doing that tableau in the mirror, then the window. Like, and it feels very traditional, like pre-spaghetti Western and the anti-Western period.
If you're going with that, absolutely. No, no, no. I mean, like, the music as well, you know, they're invoking a John Ford-esque, you know, soundscape with that sort of massive Bernard Herrmann type score, you know, that invokes, you know, the planes and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. They could have easily gone for something a bit more low key, or, you know, it was never going to be that, was it, with a 20 million budget for a Western. It was always going to be something a bit more out the box thinking, or in the box thinking, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just going back to what you're saying about George, I think, is it Cosmatos?
Cosmatos.
Yeah. Obviously, his son is Paco. Is it Cosmatos or Cosmatos? Either way, he's the guy who directed Mandy with Nicolas Cage. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that he did Cobra and what was the other film?
Rambo First Blood Part 2.
So this guy is 100% a canon journeyman. So he's a Golan and Glover stooge, isn't he? So he's obviously been. He's been drafted in, and then it's like, you can just sit back and I'll do all the work and we'll give you the credit for it. And he's going, yeah, sound, sorted, no worries. No, get my name on a £20 million budget, happy days.
Yeah. I'm now not sure about my pronunciation. I think it's
just do it.
There is a connection here as well, because you mentioned the director of Mandy, Panos Cosmatos. The funny thing about his career is that the royalties that his father George got from this movie, he put into his first movie, Beyond the Black Rainbow.
Oh, yeah.
And that's how we got that film, from this film.
That's crazy. That's brilliant as well at the same time. That's excellent.
And I think, like, I, of the three of us, have the least relationship to this film, because I had only seen it once before, in my mid-teens, and then I'm seeing it again today. And, like, yeah, I think it's a good film, but I don't think it's a great film. And I think a part of that for me is I'm not a huge Western fan.
Yeah.
I do like spaghetti Westerns, and I do like revisionist Westerns, but I'm not a huge traditional Western fan. So that, you know, that is, and I think part of my thing as well is it's trying to do if it was purely just doing its own thing and just being like, well, we're a traditionalist Western, like, that's fine, but there is elements where you're kind of like, it's trying to have its cake and eat it. It's trying to be a super entertaining film and kind of a serious film, and it's trying to be like a traditionalist Western, but with some kind of revisionist side notes, which I don't think entirely works. Although I will say, I do still think it's a very good movie, and I still think it's a very entertaining movie.
Yeah. I mean, you can tell, I guess, watching it that, because, I mean, we'll go and talk about how so much got cut from the script, and you've already mentioned it, Scott, but you can kind of tell there's elements within it, because I know, even my father, he was reading some Wyatt Earp book, and there's moments where it talks about that before the elements of Tombstone or whatever, you know, Wyatt Earp over here at least, and, you know, in this movie is seen as this amazing lawman, like the hero's hero type of thing. Kind of, you find out that before any of that, he wasn't really, you know, that great hero that he was made out to be before that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I know it's hinted at in this movie, but it's never expanded upon of him being, you know, kind of talking about the conscience thing, that he kind of has all this guilt, and that, you know, I don't know, fire or killing a man or stuff like that, and kind of these elements, but then it never really explores it, I guess, to the point that then it tries to. Yeah, there, I can get what you're saying, Scott, where there's moments where it's like trying to go in that, down that rabbit hole, I guess, but then not.
Yeah. But I suppose, as always, we actually, to be fair, we stayed relatively disciplined because usually we go on a tangent and then talk about the plot of the movie. Yes. We are still talking about the film we're talking about. So that is still showing a level of discipline, but we are a little bit in and we've not started, talking about the plot of the movie yet. So we should probably do that.
Let's
so,
do
I think, like since you're the special guest, Wayne, you can kick us off and tell us how Tombstone starts.
I wasn't expecting this.
Sorry.
Okay, no, I'll go for it. It opens with a monologue about the Old West, about how everything's been going, you know, how it's found itself in the middle of this sort of coming to the end and it's fighting against leaving the Old West behind. And then we meet our gang and we find ourselves in Arizona. and they use this this great shot from the Great Train Robbery, which is obviously 19, it's credited as the first ever Western film ever made from 1903, which is 9 minutes long and it's on YouTube. And if you're a film buff and you haven't seen it, it's 9 minutes of your life and it's brilliant. Give it a watch. And they explain about the red sashes and that's how cowboys identify themselves. And they're sort of like the first organized crime gang, as it were. They're the original mafia in the Old West, as it were. You want me to carry on or?
No.
You want to take over?
Craig, do you want to go for next? Yeah. What happens after we get the introductory monologue, which is done by Robert Mitchum, who was supposed to have a role in the movie, but like due to ill health, I think didn't have an on-screen role in the movie, but he was supposed to appear as Old Man Clanton, but he didn't. Okay. But he does get to narrate both the start and the end of the movie. But back to you, Craig.
Yeah. So you kind of, because it's a Western and I don't know why this is a common trope, you see a Mexican wedding is about to occur and the cowboys basically ride in and they, because of the fact that the police killed two of their men, they decide to shoot up the whole town, killing, you know, everybody and then even killing the groom because he wouldn't, you know, get down on his knees and he wouldn't surrender to them. And then it's assumed that they then do something to his new bride.
Rough that, really rough. Yeah. Found that really, really rough in the first 7 minutes of the film.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they, then during this whole thing, you kind of, and there are
also like, I did want to mention as well, like, and this goes to something that happens in the plot later, but everybody else is fine with this bride being dragged into the church for, you know, presumably not a fun time. And
sorry, it was a very diplomatic way of saying rape.
Yes, like I wasn't sure to, like whether to say that or not. But yes, that is implied what is going to happen.
Yes.
She is going to be raped, and everybody's fine with that, apart from Michael Rooker's character Sherman McMaster, who is. He's fine with it enough that he doesn't stop anything, but pulls a funny face as if to say, "Well, that's a bit distasteful."
And that's the thing. So Michael Rooker, and I know we'll talk about it when he comes up again, but where the script, I feel like there were so many other subplots because he's there. You see his face do that, no lines. And it's not until like an hour later that or more that he pops up again. It's like, oh, I don't believe in what they're doing anymore. Like, oh yeah, you were there. You're in this movie. But that's how you look at a lot. You had Thomas Hayden Church, you had Michael Rooker, you have I can't think of the actor's name, but I know he was in what, Six in the City or My Big Fat Greek Wedding, or he's been in a ton of stuff. Your Powers Booth, there's a huge cast in this movie.
It's a crazy cast. Yeah,
Michael Bean as well, of course. Yeah. Is it Bine Bean? Why the hell do you say
Bean? I think Michael Bean.
Stephen Lang.
What a piece of shit Stephen Lang is. I'm going to say that every time you mention his name. What a piece of shit.
And So in this whole thing, a scene that I really like, and again, it's only really expanded upon at the very end duel, but you see when they're shooting all of the policemen and they're kind of all enjoying themselves, that Ringo, who's supposed to be the fastest guy in the West, you kind of see this nervousness and this terror in his eyes of like, he doesn't know what to do and he's kind of frightened about it, but you know, they lose that again until the very end where he's fighting Doc Holliday. But yeah, it becomes this, you get that. And the only person he's willing to kill is the priest, who is basically saying that, you know, they're going to get their judgment and quoting the Bible revelations of, you know, the man with no name riding a pale horse and bringing all hell with it, or whatever, however the phrase goes for people that I guess are religious. I'm not, so I only know from the movie perspective of how it's quoted, but. Yep.
I wonder if that's a sly way of quoting Sergio Leone's The Man With No Name trilogy. You know,
no-name
man riding a pale horse. I wonder if that's a sly way of doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could very well be. There's a lot of, like, Western references in the movie. Yeah. So, like, that's probably a good catch there, Wayne.
Mm. Yeah. But, yeah, so they basically slaughter up this town. He kills the priest. He says the meaning of what was being said, and then that's when you get to, and the very big exposition of, because throughout this movie everybody talks about, if you cut out all the scenes of them talking about Wyatt Earp, you'd get like 30 minutes less. yeah, it's basically all a lead up to, they're going to face retribution by one man, and then we go into the train pulls up and who steps out but Wyatt Earp.
I love the cut though. I love the edit here where he's talking about, you know, death riding on a pale horse kind of stuff, and then it immediately cuts to Kurt Russell's face and you're like, good times.
Slapping a man because he was hitting his horse.
This is the thing, because like later on in the movie they try and do this thing where it's like, who's really the bad guys here, you know, like the Earps and the Clantons, they're really just mirror images of each other. But at the start of the movie you have like the Clantons being evil douchebags, and then like immediately we're introduced to Wyatt Earp, and within 2 seconds he has the save the cat moment of like slapping a guy who mistreats a horse and then taking that horse away and being like, yeah, because Wyatt Earp doesn't stand for animal cruelty.
Yeah, I know. And it's, I agree with that, because there's that point after they kill those men, and we'll get into it obviously after the OK Corral. And you're supposed to feel like, oh, that we were wrong in killing the men. You're like, wait a minute. 40 minutes ago, you just killed a bunch of innocent town people, raped a woman. Like, I'm not feeling bad for any of you guys in this whole dilemma here.
Yeah.
So then, he comes up and he slaps the man, gets his horse, and then we get basically this kind of tableau where his family joins him and they talk, and a lot of the opening is them just talking about how great it is that they're all going to be a family together and start a new life. And they have, like, they stand in front of the window and look at themselves as one great family. But you're introduced to Virgil, to Morgan, his brothers, and then their wives, and then also Wyatt Earp's wife, who is, we get the hint that she's addicted to
laudanum.
Yeah, laudanum. But it's very happy for the most part, besides that.
Apart from the fact that, like, Wyatt's wife is probably a dope fiend. It's all good.
Yeah.
I've got a very diplomatic note of, we see Wyatt Earp's wife has a problem.
See, we're all trying to be diplomatic here. We're all... And then we get the introduction of the best character in the movie. It's Doc Holliday.
Yes.
And like, and one of a career high performances, from Val Kilmer, who's just playing a card game. The other guy's not very happy because he's losing the card game, and he mocks him and says, "Oh, he's not that tough without his guns and stuff." But then he puts his guns on the table, and I've put my notes here. Doc, just as deadly with a knife. just attacks that guy, stabs him.
So, Doc Holliday, I'm obviously going out on a limb and feeling biased, but I mean, his portrayal of Doc Holliday is just, it's not even a career high for Val Kilmer, in my opinion. I think he's one of the best just Western characters in his portrayal, because it's so theatrical and every line he gives is just like, I don't know, the whole bit, it cracks you up at times where he's like saying the whole thing about, oh, well, we can't be friends anymore. I don't know what I'd think if you couldn't be my friend. And he's like saying all this stuff and the way he delivers it and he's drunk basically the whole movie and dying from TB. And
yeah, I mean, Kilmer plays it in such a, I agree completely. He's never been better than mm-hmm. I mean, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang maybe, because he's brilliant in that as well. But it's one of those performances. It drags your eye to him. Doesn't matter what's going on the screen. You're watching Doc Holliday because he's the charisma. He's the charisma of the entire film. And you'd think Kurt Russell as Wyatt Earp would be, but he's the sort of, the moral compass of the film. Whereas Doc Holliday is his compass of morality is very wayward. You know, like you were saying in this scene where we first meet him and his lady friend go and rob the saloon straight after. You know, he kills this guy and they rob the saloon. There's no two ways about it. He's got a moral ambiguity to him as Doc Holliday, and it's brilliant. It's so well done by Kilmer.
Yeah, I like. I wanted to pick you up, Wayne, on the you know, I'm robbing the saloon, because in my notes I've put most chill robbery in the world, because he just slides his hand across a card table and picks up the money and just walks out, and everybody's like, "Ah, oh, that Doc Holliday, what a waggy guy!" And nothing happens.
Yeah, I just assume that everybody's scared the shit out of it. You know,
it's true.
He's just, you know, so cool about everything. It's like, it's unpredictable, I suppose. You don't know what he's going to do next. So they're like, oh, screw it. It's only money.
Well, that's the whole thing with him and Ringo. Like, everybody's afraid of him because he's the only character in it that doesn't care if he dies, I guess, or doesn't have. So it's like, so unpredictable that everybody's afraid of him.
And also, like, Michael Biehn has like crazy eyes. He does great crazy eyes in this movie.
He does.
Also, like, I would also agree with you, Wayne, that like its closest competitors as a performance in Val Kilmer's filmography, I would say, is his performance as Perry in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, or his performance as Jim Morrison in The Doors.
Oh yeah,
well, I have no reference. I haven't seen The Doors, unfortunately. Yeah. But yeah, and I know it's one of those where it's like universal across the board. Yeah, he does a fantastic interpretation of Jim Morrison. So but somebody says Val Kilmer's here, what's the first thing you think of? It's, you know, it's not Weird Science. They're not weird, not Top Secret, is it? Or
I do love him in Top Secret. I've seen Top Secret more than I've seen this movie.
Why would you not? It's fantastic. But I'm saying, when you say Val Kilmer to me, this is the film or Iceman in Top Gun. They're the two.
Of course. Yeah.
Those two,
I mean, he's just one of those actors, and it's a shame because I think, you know, he's one where his ego got the best of him and stuff like that. And then he was drinking, I want to say, but I don't know. He's just one of those actors where everything he's in, like, you can't deny he just takes all of the attention. He's just incredible.
He's got old Hollywood charisma. That's what he's got. You know, speaking of old, like Robert Mitchum, you know, it's old Hollywood charisma. No matter what you do, you're going to be able to get work because you have that undeniability. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the only time I've seen him, there's only been a couple of times where I think he hasn't like stolen things. And it's generally when he's either in the lead or he's with somebody who has equal charisma. Where they're just kind of like in Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, where him and Cage are just going at it. Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
I've seen that film once and I obviously wiped it from memory because I don't remember Val Kilmer being in that at all. So.
Roll on though. We roll into Tombstone itself, the town of Tombstone. We get look at Tombstone as the Earps ride into town, and we are introduced to County Sheriff Behan,
Sorry, Scott. Can I just pull you back 1 second there?
Yep.
So as they ride into town, they go past. It's called Bast Hill Cemetery. Did you see the tombstone?
Yeah.
Did you
Four Slugs from a 44, no less, no more.
Oh, I absolutely love it. Yeah, Here Lies Less No More, Four Slugs from a 44, no less, no more. I had to rewind it and pause it because it was just so good. I love that.
Yeah. I'm glad you stopped the podcast for that. We definitely needed to mention that because, that cracked me up as well because it was like, oh, that's a random fun shot they've kept in there.
It's absolutely true as well. That's how they used to write the tombstones, just random sort of limerick, as it were, about these people died. I also think it may be a tip of the hat to Blazing Saddles as
indeed. Although, a lot of the period detail in this film is like ridiculous. Yeah. Like the sets for Tombstone were, as close as you could get to recreations of Tombstone, and all the clothes are, period correct and stuff like that. They were wearing fucking period appropriate wool in Arizona temperatures, which was real hard on them during filming. But, I listened to an interview with the behind the scenes documentary where the production designer, Catherine Hardwick, who would go on to direct 13 and less successfully Twilight, she was talking about all the stuff that they did to get period correct wallpaper and period correct lighting fixtures, and I think a lot of that comes from Kevin Jarre's obsession of getting everything right and being detail focused.
I know nothing about filmmaking, and that just sounds like a bastard chore. That does, doesn't it? Jesus.
Yeah. Well, and this is also kind of where we get. We also have to mention because it pops up a lot, it's not the fast riding montages, but the throwback to the Western. We get Anna scenes in the beginning of them, seeing, the horse and buggies or whatever it is, where it's just, a couple minutes of just watching them ride around.
Yeah.
So we get all that too.
Yeah. Which it's obviously a kind of tip of the hat to the kind of classic kind of John Ford stuff.
Wagon train and the searches and Rio Grande, things like anything with a wagon train in, basically, you've got to have a shot in a Western with a wagon train. Otherwise, it's not a Western. You know what I mean?
that's very true. Or John Ford's ERP movie, My Darling Clementine.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that he did one.
I had no idea that was John Ford. And I thought I knew most of his films. I had no idea. You just schooled me there, Scott.
It's just because I was looking things up today.
and so this is where we get, I know I kind of mentioned it prior, but where it, I don't know. I know I messaged you about it, Scott, where there are elements that, and it goes back to the 1950s style, what we were just talking about, where it gets kind of, I put hokey as a way, but it's also, I don't know, where they get into town and Wyatt is basically propositioned to be the new sheriff and he denies it. And then he hears about, they call it the Oriental, the saloon, which isn't doing well, but it's a wonderful place. And he goes and walks away and you have Virgil go, oh, that Wyatt, as Sam Elliott, which, I love Sam Elliott, but
everybody loves Sam Elliott, don't they?
You get that whole kind of element where that is, I think it feels like for the next 30 minutes, you have people either talking about Wyatt or introducing Wyatt, or it's just all of the stuff where that's all it is people just how can we put Wyatt even more on some pedestal
they're building his mythology for so you're sort of it's a origin story in effect, it's a superhero origin story, you're getting sort of the back end of it so you can move on and go, I can't wait for him to get his guns out, it's going to be great,
he goes into the saloon and the reason why nobody's going in there is because of a young Billy Bob Thornton.
the marshal tells him, mate, you can't go into the Oriental because it's a real slaughterhouse. So he just walks across the road into it. It's brilliant.
That's how we know he's a badass.
Yeah.
If we weren't already convinced enough.
Yeah. What's funny is they talk about it being this real slaughterhouse. So you're assuming, oh, that must be where all those cowboys hang out. And it's just wild and, punching or whatever. And you go in and there's just four people in there.
Yeah,
it's Billy Bob Thornton yelling at people.
Billy Bob Thornton and a bucket of chicken, that's all he's got.
Yeah.
But I was reading as well that apparently his kind of confrontation with Billy Bob in the Oriental, like, that wasn't part of the script. Like, Billy Bob Thornton was just told, he was just given the direction, act like a bully, and then he just improvised, like, his lines in the Oriental.
I'm surprised how many times Billy Bob Thornton, it sounds like that's a recurring thing of him just improvising. Like, they just tell him to improvise a scene.
Yeah.
I feel like that's happened a bunch. But no, I love the, so again, Wyatt Earp is slapping him around. But, this whole build up, I love, and I think it's hilarious. And we'll get into when they come back, meet Doc Holliday. But I wrote down in the notes the weird, however Wyatt phrases it, where he says, skin that smoke wagon and see what happens, and then, like, and jerk it out. And, like, he's, like, using all these kind of weird phrases as he's slapping him around, and then he just basically pulls him by the ear like a child.
Yeah.
And throws him out.
Yeah.
He gives the fantastic line of, you're going to do something or just stand there and bleed.
Yeah.
It's a great line. He has some build, like, while Doc Holliday gets most of the best lines, Kurt Russell does, like, as Wyatt Earp, does have some belters as well.
Yeah.
I did want to, because I've written it down my notes, and I did want to mention something that happens just a little bit before, where they meet the county sheriff, Bean, who's played by John Denny.
What a piece of shit he is as well. What a piece of shit he is as well.
Yeah, he absolutely is. But we know that he's a piece of shit straight away, because he is talking about all his different roles, where he's like, I'm county sheriff, and also, like, I'm on the, you know, town housing planning and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm the tax collector. And he is also the chair of the non-partisan anti-Chinese league.
Yep. I wrote that down as well because I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
I was like, say what? And nobody blinks. And nobody's like, hang on, wind up again. Like, what's that? Non-partisan anti-Chinese?
Yeah. No, I'm surprised there hasn't been a Western that's dealt with it, because there's so many Westerns that will reference, like, even McCabe and Mrs. Miller talks about, like, all the kind of crimes against Chinese and stuff like that during it, the Chinese immigrants, but yet nobody really, in, like, trying to revise Westerns or make an anti-Western, nobody's really made one about the, like, Chinese immigrants during the Western
period. I assume because all of that history has been burnt and forgotten as best they can, because it's the period of American history I'm pretty sure nobody wants to remember. Yeah. So, yeah.
That's what we do best.
Just going back to Billy Bob Thornton, I mean, yeah. Just going through the cast, and we mentioned loads and loads of the cast. My note I wrote down was, it's like the Saving Private Ryan of Westerns.
Yeah.
It's like you can't turn around for hitting either a future star or a star.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Everybody in every role has either gone on to bigger things or was a big star at the time. I don't know whether it's because it's been a while since I watched it, but I don't remember that. So I'm sort of sitting there going, holy shit, that's Powers Booth, and holy shit, that's Michael Bain, you know? And,
yeah.
And then, of course, we got some more coming up as well.
Yeah.
That's true.
And now.
Because we get a pair of actors coming out of Carriage, and one of those actors is, like, they're actors in the movie as well as being actors.
Yeah.
But one of those actors is Billy Zane.
Oh, wait. I guess jumping back a little bit to finish the Billy Bob Thornton section, what cracks me up, and then why Doc is so great, is that they see Doc, they kind of meet him and say, oh, what are you doing in this town? And they're having this interaction, and you're having Billy Bob Thornton come out with a shotgun ready to kill Wyatt Earp, and that's why he's stopped by Doc. And then he's just standing there with the shotgun as Doc and the Earps are talking, and then he does the whole, oh, Johnny, I apologize, I forgot you were there.
Yeah,
you can leave. Like, it's this whole,
as he's just, I did write that down in my notes as well, actually. Yeah. Yeah, that was real fun.
And then he says, what he's also talking about, because it introduces the other guys that eventually help the Earps too, where Doc ends up saying, like, it's very cosmopolitan as a joke because they just witness two men, or these two men shoot. Yeah. Because, yeah. It is.
A full on, lawful murder is what it is.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And, this is where we get the introduction of, Wyatt's, soon to be love interest, despite his marriage. Josephine Marcus, played by Dana Delaney.
And it's very on the nose, and it's like everybody in the town knows that Wyatt has a thing for her, she has a thing for him. I don't know. It's broadcasted, especially by Doc, a lot.
Well, it's broadcasted by Wyatt himself. Like, yeah. I have literally written in my notes, when they go to the theater show, I've literally written, Earp doesn't even try to hide his perving. Like, in front of his wife. He's just like,
it's a different time, Scott. Scott,
that woman is so beautiful.
It's a different time, Scott. What are you doing? It's the 18th century. What are you doing? It's a different time.
Well, yeah, that's why I'm curious in the original draft if there was more with his wife, because you basically, from after that point, you just see her as either more drugged up, or she's like trying to connect with him and then he doesn't want to, and then she's like, oh, okay, never mind, I'll leave. He's like, no, it's okay, we can do something. She's like, no, it's fine. And then she goes and does more like opium or whatever. And but that's her whole character from this point on.
Well, that there is a mouthful for every woman in the film. Dana Delaney. Not one of them has any motivation other than to be a wife and to be there when something goes wrong to mop up the blood. There's no agency from the women. It is in that sense sort of like an old John Ford Western, where it's, you know, it's a manly country is the old West.
Yeah, no, definitely. And
I think that's like, this would be jumping ahead. We can jump back again, but, to kind of, go off of that point, Wayne, I think that was another one of this movie's kind of half-arsed things, where we do have like this speech from Josephine, just not long after Wyatt meets her, where she's like, you know, the kind of strong, independent woman speech. And then like, she has no agency after that. It's like, oh, we're going to give her a badass introduction and then we're going to do nothing with her after.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going back again. This is 1993, and from the last 5 years, obviously our world has completely moved on, rightly so. But we're going back to 1993, where, you know, it's the Bechdel test. Is it passed in this film? I don't think so. You know, I don't think it's anywhere near it, but it's one of them where they've got to put them in there, but they really don't know what to do with them at all.
Yeah. Yet the only point where it could potentially pass is like the quick scene where she runs in to tell them, I think something bad's about to happen or whatever. And it's like, and then the guy busts in and shoots up the, you know, obviously that's jumping way ahead, but shoots up their house. Like, that's the only time you actually see multiple women interacting with one another in the whole thing.
I don't think there's a scene in the film where there's a woman on screen without a man, is there, at all?
Yeah.
I don't think there is one, is there? There's always a member of our either good guy party or villain party in the scene with one of these guys. So where are we now, boys? We're at the theatre, aren't we? That's where we've just got to, isn't it?
We're at the theatre, where, and I've written in my note, like, because one of the things that all the cowboys, I'm not quite sure why the cowboys would be at a theatre show, but they are anyway, and they amuse themselves by, like, shooting at the axe. Yeah. And one of the things that entertained me most about this, and I've written in my notes, is gunshots can't throw off Zane's Shakespeare.
Yeah.
He's incredible. No, I mean, that's what he is.
That's how good Billy Zane is. I mean, people don't give him credit for it.
But tell you what, have either of you seen Kenneth Branagh's Henry V?
I have not, actually.
Yeah. Nothing compared to Billy Zane's. Nothing.
Fair enough. I'll take your word for it.
Yeah.
Oh, talk about cast again. In this scene, you've already mentioned the guy from Sex and the City. That's John Corbett.
Yeah. That's who. Yeah.
Jason Priestley now turns up.
Yeah.
And Terry O'Quinn from, for those of you who don't know Terry O'Quinn, and you're not JAG fans, he's Locke from Lost. He turns up as well.
Oh, yeah, no.
And if you're a horror fan, you might know him from The Stepfather.
Okay, yeah. And I like how he's, because normally, so you have the marshal or whatever, and you have the mayor. I like that the mayor is actually a decent guy, which is kind of different in some weird Western way, where you're expecting him to be like, oh, well, town money and greedy, just like whatever. But he's kind of the one that even talks to the marshal later on. Like, isn't that your job to like bring the peace when, you know, Powers Booth is shooting all over the place when he's high on opium or all this sort of stuff. So he kind of plays this decent character. But Jason Priestley, I did put Billy Zane and homoeroticism because they definitely put that in there, but and then it doesn't go anywhere. You know, you have like these little, like these two little scenes when he's there and then the other interaction that they have, I guess, after he's.
Yeah, I was kind of confused by that. Like, because I was thinking, was that. Is that a drop subplot or something, or is that just something they've added on top for no reason? Because there's definitely the suggestion that Jason Priestley's character Billy has a crush on Billy Zane's character Mr. Fabian, but like it's just we can't delve into it any further.
Can you just one before we go? Can any of you, either of you, tell me what is the point of Jason Priestley in this film?
No,
I couldn't figure it out.
He's a deputy marshal, but you don't really know that until.
Oh, you don't know that until way later in the film. He's just like the cowboy stooge that they kind of like make fun of, and he just kind of hangs out with them anyway.
Yeah, it's one of those characters. I mean, by the time you find out who he is, I still didn't care.
Yeah.
Like, okay, you can cut this character completely, and I got him confused completely with a character from Young Guns 2.
Okay.
So I kept expecting him to be drawing like little sketches and things of the cowboys, and I was like, he hasn't drawn anything yet. What's going on?
Yeah.
I was like, I think I've got the character wrong maybe.
Yeah, this is a nothing character. Yeah, he doesn't do anything.
They even give him that big moment, his kind of last scene. You see him where he finds, again, spoiler alert, and we're jumping ahead, but where Billy Zane, he finds him dead, and then he's basically like, oh, I can't do this anymore, and he rides off quitting the cowboys and leaving that marshal because he has this change of heart. But again, like, but it doesn't have any weight behind it because we don't even know who you are, and you haven't really, we just know you like Billy Zane and now you are upset with the cowboys and that's it, right?
Yeah, but I think We've kind of shat on a bunch of things in the movie. Yes. So let's talk about one of the high points that comes just not long after the theater things, where it's one of my personal favorite scenes in the movie. Johnny Ringo and Doc Holliday have a Latin off.
I literally wrote, I was going to say, I'm surprised you said it too. In my notes, I wrote Latin off with cup spin. Exclamation point.
Oh, yeah. Everything about this. I love everything about this scene. Yeah. I love the pistol spinning. I love the cup spinning. I love the Latin off. I love the crazy eyed looking Michael Biehn's face. Like Val Kilmer's little thing about like, I think I hate him. Like, I don't know, like, I know I hate him. You know, like, everything's so good.
Yeah. This bit is fantastic. Yeah. And it sort of shows you I mean, Doc looks worse and worse throughout the film. And that sort of pallid skin that they do in him. The makeup job on that is fantastic because I believed it 100%. You know, so I think that when the cameras roll, they give Val Kilmer some oxygen or something. You know what I mean? When they called cut. That's how believable I thought it was.
Yeah.
There's another bit with Stephen Lang, who is a piece of shit, where he says to, he leans over the table. This is just before the Latin off. He leans over the table to Wiretap, and he says, Lord, don't go around here. Love that.
Well, Stephen Lang is Ike.
He's a piece of shit.
Yeah. So it's one of those Western characters or in a bunch of action movies where he's like the cowardly, crappy character that they keep letting live for some reason. Yeah. And he keeps doing horrible things. And so throughout the whole movie, you're like, why haven't they just killed him yet? They've killed all the other people. Just kill him already.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this is supposed to be the scene that really, even though we've spent it introducing all the characters and bringing them in, this is like the scene where they're all now together in one place, and she sees Wyatt and he sees her, but he's trying to ignore her while he's dealing cards. And then you also have the Jason Priestley and Billy Zane part where he invites him to sit with him, then eventually goes, that's the scene in itself, doesn't go anywhere. And you're kind of, now they're all chatting a little bit, but not really. It's just now they're all in the same place and we're kind of, okay, now we can get things rolling. because they're all ready to go.
Yeah, that's the sort of the end of the first act, isn't it? Like you get everything together and you introduce everybody, so all the moving parts can then be oiled for the second part, isn't it?
Yeah, and that, of course, where we get kind of what there's more philosophy elements where they talk about the white light after you die, which is Bill Paxton's really only big thing, I guess. I kind of wish he was in it a little bit more, but then after that, we get kind of another jump back from the grittiness to then having this romantic ride that just kind of feels a little out of place a little bit.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit. And as I mentioned, like the character of Josephine kind of gets this badass speech about how she's not a proper lady. And then like just as it's been a recurring theme throughout the seasons we've done is like female characters often start out interesting and then immediately become uninteresting. And although I did love her little bit of patronizing Wyatt, I thought that was very funny, where she explained the meaning of fortuitous to him, like he's an idiot.
Yeah, and we know that he wants to settle down, but she knows better because they're the type of people that want to just live off room service and travel around and whatever.
It's one of those things that, you know, they do the flirty McFlirt face and it's sort of, you could have cut that scene in half, maybe. You know, and just cracked on with it. But I like the whole, I'm an oak, all right. I enjoyed that bit. Because it's just because it's Kurt Russell delivering that line. I think if anybody else would just go, oh, what a load of shit that is.
I'm on the same page with you there. I mean, effectively, like you say, Wayne, I think, you know, they felt that they needed to have female characters, but they didn't know what to do with them. So in essence, it becomes like they knew so little of what to do with them that you could effectively cut them out in the movie and it made no difference.
Yeah, I think they're sort of going for, I think it's Rio Grande, the John Wayne film. They get their Maureen O'Hara story in there with that, and it's a complex relationship. But Maureen O'Hara's got presence and there's a lot for her to do in that, even though it's little. Whereas in this, it's just, I think it's there just to show you that Wyatt hasn't left that, you know, lawman life and that sort of thing. He's still, you know, chasing everything.
I know from what I read up that Kurt Russell really wanted to refine and focus strictly on the relationship between Wyatt and Doc. I think not directing it, wink wink. I wish I could have seen the original script and just see if there was more for them to do or something. If they cut out the stuff, a lot of the stuff to just focus strictly on Doc and Wyatt, but it'd be interesting.
I will mention, like, in terms of like, Kurt, you know, wink wink, not directing. want to say that I think it's refreshing and fun to be talking about a man who it seems like a good guy, you know, like it's not like we've had Seagal and Stallone, just mountains of ego. And here is Kurt Russell. He cut some of his scenes out of the movie to gain the trust of the cast for this project going forward. He cut out some of his own scenes in terms of getting the running time down. And he just seems like a good dude, and I just wanted to point that out, and it's a fun, refreshing thing.
He is a Disney kid, after all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He did cut his teeth back in, the Computer Wore Tennis Shoes?
Yeah, the Computer Wore Tennis Shoes, one of his first films, way back in 1969.
Do you know what his first film is?
I don't know what his first film is, but that's one of his early films.
His first film is it happened at the World's Fair with Elvis.
Oh,
right.
When he was like 10 years old, I think it is. So if you ever get a chance to do that, you'll see a very, 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 very young Kurt Russell.
Okay. I've not seen that. Fair enough.
That's my life. I spend watching old westerns and Elvis movies. There
you go. Fair play.
Yeah. And so after this whole ordeal, and we get another quick scene, which is just there to remind us that his wife does drugs. Something, you know, where it has to be brought up again. Is that the same bottle that can't remember it was if it was Morgan or Virgil's wife who gave her the bottle of it, but it's clear that she's kind of moved on to a new bottle and going a little bit harder with it.
I actually like this scene because I think it sets up what's to come on that evening. You know, the tone changes. He's been out riding with Josephine in the afternoon, and you know what could have been. You know, out riding and flirting and having this nice time in the daisy fields, and then he comes home and a smash of reality smacks him around the face and his wife's addiction. And I like that it balances right there and tips. So you understand that the next scene is sort of, it brings you along to that next, you know, scene out in the out in Tombstone.
Yeah, no, I agree, because it takes us to, like, what is it, Curly Bill,
yeah.
Who decides to do a bunch of opium and then fire an infinite number of shots from the six shooters, apparently, because it doesn't, he never reloads, but he just is firing all about town. And this is kind of where you get the marshal is being told, even by the mayor, shouldn't you handle this? And he's like, well, it's not my jurisdiction. It's the sheriff's. And the sheriff reluctantly goes out.
Yeah, poor old sheriff, yeah.
Yeah, and Curly Bill doesn't even, he also kind of feels, he doesn't know what he's doing, so he's not entirely sinister, I guess, in that. He shoots him, but then since he's so doped up, he doesn't realize that he just killed him. But yeah, we get even more Wayne, for your benefit, Stephen Lang, to really show that he's a coward. I mean, I love this part where Wyatt points the gun at his forehead.
Yeah, that's a great
And he says, well, I might, you know, your guys might get me in a rush, but I'll turn your head into a canoe, and they're still going to do it. And he's like, no, he's not joking or something. He's not bluffing.
What a fantastic line that is.
Oh, talking about good lines, we did miss a Kilmer line just previously when he was sitting playing piano at the bar where the guy like he's saying like, oh, are you playing? And then he rhymes off like this, you know, this other guy's
Camptown Lady songs. And,
And then he says, oh no, it's a nocturne. And the guy goes, what's that? And he goes, Frederick fucking Chopin.
And that guy who's saying that is Thomas Hayden Church, who, you know, again, another one of the,
he's very young in this movie.
Right,
yeah. He is.
This is a thing that kind of came up in last week's recording. So like in last week's recording, we, you know, like, as the audience will be well aware, we talked about Backdraft. And in the Backdraft episode that I recorded with, Caleb, I asked him if Scott Glenn is a vampire, because he has always looked like that and still looks like that. And, I'm going to ask the same question about Sam Elliott. Is Sam Elliott a vampire? Because he has always looked like that and still looks like that.
It's the mustache mode. It's all his power is in that mustache. It's like his kryptonite. You take that mustache off, he's dead. That's it.
So I fully believe that. I 100% believe that one.
So I finally watched the movie. It's the horror movie Frogs. And and Sam Elliott's in it, and I didn't even recognize it because he has brown hair, no mustache. He's like the lead in it, and it's from the I can't remember the exact date. But I was just watching it because it was on this collection of DVDs I had. I was like, whatever, try it. And I was very surprised. I was like, wait, no, that can't be Sam Elliott.
that's weird. I can't even imagine Sam Elliott without a mustache. It's a bit like watching Deliverance and being like, why is Burt Reynolds not got a mustache? What is going on here?
Brilliant.
But we have Sam Elliott, basically, you know, he's the good guy here, and he realizes that there has to be law and order in a town, and that he can't take money away from all these town folk and then, you know, just let them all fall, especially when a kid's about to get run over.
Oh yeah.
And he sees the mother of the kid, who's upset, and she also has a scar across her face, and he decides he's going to become the new sheriff.
It's a good little bit of expositional scene that, you know, that 90 seconds, so that the mayor turns up, gives him a load of shit and says, you're going to stand for this. This is what the town's turning into, and you can do something about it. And then obviously, like you say, the kid nearly gets run over, and it's just a nice little, you can see the chain of thought of, can I stand by and let this happen? It's well done. It's well written.
Yeah. And then Morgan.
On a kind of totally random note, just before we kind of get that scene, there's like a wagon that goes by through the town that's like this movie's one bit of feminism, where there's a wagon of all these women on it that says equal pay for equal work. And I was fair enough.
Just It sort of sums up every lady in this film, doesn't it? Just yeah. on a wagon, just moving out of shot. You know. That.
yeah. yeah.
And don't blink during that scene because you won't see it.
No.
Oh wow!
I almost missed it. I was like, yeah. I was like, what? Oh, okay, fair enough. Random.
They look so happy about equal rights for equal pay as well, don't they?
Yeah.
They look the most miserable. They are the most miserable looking women I've ever seen.
Till I stopped and read the board, I thought, Jesus, they're on the way to the noose, like. That's where they're going.
Yeah, it did look like they were being led to their death. Oh, Jesus Christ.
So we get, oh, we're up to now. This is where Virgil becomes Mr. Popular, isn't it? He takes on the mayor's advice and he gets sworn in as is it a marshal or a sheriff?
A marshal.
Because we kind of got a bit confused because it was the town marshal that got shot by Curly Bill, and Behan is the county sheriff.
Okay. So sheriff is the CEO marshals. And the marshal is the next one, like runs the towns sort of thing. Yeah. Got ya.
Yeah.
So we found out that Curly Bill has been released 3 weeks later because the judge is a piece of shit. Must be from the Stephen Lang school of being a piece of shit. He just says, was anybody there to witness it? No, nobody witnessed it. Well, it didn't happen then. So the marshal must have shot himself, apparently. So they let Curly Bill out, which is just, well, it's Old West laws and was probably, I don't know, what's America like on gun law at the moment?
I don't know if I could, we're allowed to talk about.
Do you want to jump into that sort of politics?
Let's just say, I literally wrote, so when he nails up the board, that's like, you can have your guns, you can carry it, just don't keep your guns in town. I wrote Second Amendment about carrying guns. It's like still if that was today, it would still be a thing. I mean, you have people like, hey, you can't bring a gun in school. You're carried, you know, a gun you can permit, that you have a permit for, and you openly carry, and people still get upset about it. So, yeah, I guess it hasn't changed too much in short, but I won't bore you with all of that stuff.
So Virgil becomes Mr. Popular. He swears in Morgan as well, and obviously pisses off all the townsfolk by saying, you can carry your gun, just not in town. You got to hand it in the city limits. How do you police that? That's the next question.
Yeah.
Have you got like a border where you say, oh, you got to hand your gun in?
Well, it looked like it was inside, that because there's the part with Ike where it's like you just have to give it to the person, you know, to the shop owner or whatever. Because he gives his gun to the barkeep when he slaps him at that one point, whatever, which we'll get into.
Yeah, Stephen Lang, piece of shit.
Yeah, when Doc
He really is.
When Doc is playing 36 hours of poker and drinking nonstop.
Yeah.
And he's still winning. And what you have, basically, is he keeps beating Ike. Ike is upset about it.
Because he's a piece of shit.
Yeah. And basically, Virgil comes in and tells him, you're drunk, you gotta get out of here. You better not start anything. And so we're just going to go. And they all kind of start to go because Doc passes out and he starts bleeding from his mouth. So they carry him out, and Ike is talking about them being pimps and they're just taking control of the land. And I think this is another point where we're supposed to, as you were talking, Scott, see both sides of it, but we don't really. Where anyways, he keeps talking about pimps and he's going to rip their pimp heart out. And the bartender basically says, he wasn't cheating you, Ike, and he smacks him. And then he grabs his guns and he's basically saying he's going to go kill him and all that. And that's where, you know, Sam Elliott is right behind him, knocks him unconscious, and then puts him in a holding cell, which then leads to him kind of being in a drunk tank type of thing. And his friends come to pick him up, but they're not too nice either. There's like a young kid who's talking about how he's going to take Wyatt Earp down because Wyatt Earp accidentally bumped into him. And then Earp takes out his gun, the kid's gun, really quick and knocks him out. And so.
Yeah, because he says, oh, you can take that, sorry, and shove it up your ass. And then he just knocks him out with his own gun. It's very funny.
Yeah. And so, yeah, becomes that whole, that's basically it, of setting up the OK Corral. But during the time, we also get more on Doc, where he's basically told that he can't be living this life that he's living until then the doctor leaves. And then his wife gives him another cigarette You know, and she's saying how good she is to him, and she's always taking care of him, and he's like, yeah, you are good, but you may be the Antichrist or whatever.
Let's give a man who's got terminal lung disease a smoke.
And then, you know, and he's also supposed to refrain from sex and all that too. He's supposed to have like complete rest, and she does the exact opposite.
Brilliant.
Oh dear. We should have mentioned that like her character is called Big Nose Kate. I don't think it's really mentioned in the film. I think she is just, like, people say Kate in the movie, but she's credited as Big Nose Kate, and apparently that's historical figure, Big Nose Kate.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Something else.
Yeah, she has a whole Wikipedia page and everything you can look up on.
Wow.
Yeah. But, yeah.
And Big Nose Kate is played by Joanna Palooka, who the last time we met up with her was way back in our first episode when we covered Mark for Death. So there you go.
At least she's moved on to nicer cast members, I suppose.
Actually, that's a lie. Our first episode was Hard to Kill. Mark for Death was their second episode. Yeah.
And so this is the point now that I think it's the real change, because Wyatt basically says, okay, well, I guess you better swear me in. And we get the Wyatt gun we finally see. And also the wife has kind of shown of like, oh, so you're getting dressed up in your lawman's getup. And I don't know, she's still high or something. I don't know. She's just there, sitting there watching him. That's it.
Yeah.
the what I got from this scene was, I'm never going to look as cool as Kurt Russell in that scene ever in my life. Because he pulled off that hat, that gun, and that duster. That is incredible. He looked amazing. Loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it should also be mentioned that everybody in the movie grew a mustache for this movie, apart from John Tenney, who plays the actor who plays County Sheriff Behan. He's the only one who has a fake mustache. Every other mustache, authentic mustache.
Oh,
nice.
But so what? I'll actually get. So I remember reading up on the OK Corral and how there's so many movies based around the OK Corral, and they even, you know, change locations or whatever, but it's based on that. And that hearing that event really only took place over a couple of seconds, you know, and it's kind of inspired all of these films. And so it is interesting, especially this, it goes by really quick.
Mm-hmm.
And which, so I guess is more authentic, but I love how, so a lot of foreshadowing is Wyatt telling Morgan or whoever, you know, about what it's like to really kill a person, and that the fear, and he only in all of his years only killed one man. And then, but you really see during the whole thing, the fear in everybody. And I think that part works, where it's not like they're, you know, these macho men all just shooting. It's like you see that none of them really want to do it at first.
Yeah.
It's what you've been saying throughout this, like with them trying, with the tone of the film, where you're trying to get the cowboys to have a level playing field with the good guys. So there's like, there's no black and white, it's sort of gray area. And this scene is one of the biggest turning points for me with this. Because basically Wyatt goes to Morgan, Virgil, sorry, and he says, so you're going after these cowboys on a misdemeanor because they're carrying guns. You know, in essence, he's basically going after them because they've walked in the street or they've illegally parked. Yeah. That's what he's going after them for now. And it's sort of like, so you're going to pick a fight with these guys over something little, but it's, I suppose it's more about them respecting the law, and Virgil's trying to push it into him, like, you're not going to come to this town, you're not going to get away with this crap, I'm going to stop it. And I like all that, how it's sort of, it's a storm in a teacup that then gets knocked over and, you know, just spills out into everything.
Yeah.
The only problem I have with that is this scene gives the violence so much weight, and then that is completely disregarded in the second half of the movie, where it's, yeehaw, killing bad guys!
Yeah. Well, that's what you've said since the beginning of this, kind of, you know, we've already talked about, of like trying to find its place as a movie, of like being that classic Western, just killing the bad guys, or being that kind of revisionist anti-Western, that, you know, kind of making a commentary on the actual, what the West really was, and the act of violence in itself. But
yeah, I do like some of the things they get right in this.
Yeah.
Tombstone. Yeah, like, sure. Like the, if you're firing a gun, you couldn't really be that far apart, because the guns were so badly machined machined that if you stood like 20, like if you watch a Gary, if you watch High Noon, Gary yeah. Cooper shoots a man with a six shooter from about 150 feet.
Yeah.
It's like that bullet would have probably killed somebody in a different county. That's how bad these guns were. So I like that they do, they're quite close together.
Really. Yeah.
And I like, going back to this film, I like the next shot. I'm also perplexed by the next shot. When the lawmen walk towards the OK Corral and there's a house on fire behind them. It's raging and these guys just carry on to the cowboys. Shouldn't you be going and dealing with some of this fire, maybe? Not worried about these guys with guns? Because that house looks like it could burn down the whole damn town, if I'm honest. So yeah, I was a bit confused, but anybody understand that scene?
No. I have the exact same feeling as you, Wayne. That plot wise makes no fucking sense. Cinema wise looks cool as fuck.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm glad it wasn't just me because I was like, yeah, that looks amazing. But they really should be probably putting that out.
Yeah. Maybe it's to show they're on a, you know, that they're on a mission and other lives don't matter. It's only the death of these men.
I mean, as Wayne points out, you know, that fire does look like it's getting out of control and like it looks like potentially could burn the whole town down. So there wouldn't be a town to defend.
I like when they're walking towards it, Morgan just sort of tentatively looks over his shoulder as if to say, lads, fire. And they go, oh no, we're doing this. Oh, we're doing this. Right, we're doing this. Okay.
Yeah.
Also, like, you know, just looking at the looks in their eyes as well, and also in the previous scene where, you know, like Virgil, like, knocks out Ike, you know, one of the things I was thinking in this segment of the movie, I was just like, I never want to get the Sam Elliott death stare at me. I just like wilt completely. I'd just be like, I'm so sorry, whatever I did, please stop looking at me like that.
Well, it's those eyebrows too. It's not just a mustache. It's like, but this is kind of a pivotal scene in, or kind of before, right before that, in establishing even more so the Doc Holliday Wyatt Earp relationship, because Wyatt Earp is basically saying, you don't have to be here, Doc. This isn't your fight. And he's upset about it, Doc, where he's like, how dare you say that to me? And then he ends up saying it later of like, well, Wyatt Earp's my friend, so I'm doing this for him. Or like, well, Wyatt Earp has a lot of friends or something. And he says, well, I don't. Or something, you know, there's some kind of discussion about why Doc is so willing to lay down his life specifically for Wyatt, I think.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, great. And it even after the OK Corral is over, they're the ones that are left as everybody else, you know, goes off with their love interests, or even Wyatt Earp's wife comes up and then walks away again, you know. But let's get to the corral part first before we get into that.
Yeah, so the marshal turns up here, doesn't he? And he goes, oh, I've disarmed them. You haven't got to do. Also, what a piece of shit.
That's kind of one of the unfortunate things that, like, Sheriff Meehan doesn't really, he doesn't get his comeuppance. He's just like, he just disappears from the movie at a certain point. And you're like, oh, okay.
Which I wonder if he did, because that even happens with Michael Rooker when you see him, you know, we'll spoil it. When he dies, you don't see it, but you're kind of, I don't know. There's a couple moments where you're like, so did he just get killed in the montage of riding and killing that is about to happen or what?
I don't know. The Michael Rooker thing is a bit different because there is a deleted scene.
Yeah.
Where Michael Rooker kind of meets up with Johnny Ringo and the gang and then they have a little bit of a kind of confrontation and then it's kind of, he isn't killed in the scene, but you know that he's going to die. And then obviously in the movie you would see him later, as you do in the movie. But there is a deleted scene there that explains that a bit better. But, as far as I know, I don't know if there's any deleted scenes, to do with Behan.
Okay. That makes sense then. Yeah. So I guess the OK Corral, they come around the corner after Sheriff Behan jumps into the room where, she's getting pictures taken of herself, I guess. Or she's posing for some, I don't know. But, and you just see Ike, did you want to say Say it, Wayne.
I'm sorry, yeah. Stephen Lang, what a piece of shit. Yeah. I was caught up in there. Apologies.
No problem. But you see him and his head's in, they're trying to like sober up or something, which is another thing Wyatt said of just like, just wait it out and let them sober up and then they'll kind of come to their senses and leave and it'll be fine or something. But Virgil couldn't deal with that.
Nope.
Yeah, but they're just kind of hanging out. They're not even doing anything. It's not like they're causing a ruckus or anything. They're just like, his head's in water. Some of them are sitting around. They're just talking.
Yes, it's a strange moment, isn't it? Because you're like, I don't know, in my head, I had the gunfight to the OK Corral as like this big sort of, you know, standoff that's led by, it's been led to, up to by, you know, many different factors. And yeah, the factors have been there. But when you get to the OK Corral, just because they've turned up with some guns, it's not like they've took prisoners or hostages or anything.
Yeah.
Or they've rode into town and killed a boatload of people. It's just like they've rode into town and they've still got their guns. It's like, okay, so again, you're going, it's that whole, we're trying to make the cowboys look as, you know, grey area as the lawmen. And it's like, well, not really, because we already know that the cowboys are absolute pieces of shit, and they shouldn't really, you know. I feel like there was a, it needed a better reason for them to be there, if you know what I mean. They could have,
yeah.
But if they're going off sort of historical events, then I suppose they've just got to be right, haven't they? I have no idea about the OK Corral other than what I've seen in films, and this one in particular. So,
I think it's one of those. It's one of those events that it's so popular, but then, I mean, I could be wrong, but I think it's like, it was all word of mouth. So you have so many different interpretations of what
you have no reliable narrators for it.
Yeah.
He said, she said sort of thing. Yeah. Right. Okay. That makes no sense at all in this then. They could have got a different contrivance while they're there. But I suppose, like you're saying, they're trying to grey the areas, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because none of them are actually going to, when it happens, so they all kind of, they haven't drawn yet, but they're all about to. They're sitting there. And is it Thomas Hayden Church who draws first? Or is it somebody? Yeah, where?
It's basically, Thomas Hayden Church's character, Billy Clanton, he looks like he's going to draw, and Wyatt knows that he's about to draw. So they draw almost at exactly the same time, but Billy draws slightly before.
Okay, yeah, because I know it. He says Wyatt says the line where he's, I can't remember now what it's
like. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Holiday winks at him, doesn't he? Doc Holiday winks at Tom.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And he goes for his gun. He's like, oh no, don't do it. Shit. That's it now.
And it does really go with, the accuracy of those guns because they are right on each other, just firing off and it's barely hitting anything, which, you know, Virgil and, Morgan get hit in the legs or no. Morgan gets hit in the arm, right?
Yeah.
And Virgil gets hit in the leg.
Yeah, that's what I've got written down. They get wounded either in the leg or in the shoulder,
Yeah. And then Billy just takes, like, a bunch of them for a bit. They, like, unload a whole round into him. But finally, one's about to kill Doc, but Morgan's able to kill him. And as Doc also shoots him as well. And
yeah.
And then, of course, Ike throws down his guns and... as the coward.
What a piece of shit.
He runs away again to fight another day. Like you say, Craig, why they don't just kill this fucker off, we don't know, but yes.
Yeah, he runs towards Wyatt Earp and Earp says to him, you're either in the fight or you're not, or get the hell out of the way.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Quick question for you, right? So
go on.
One of the guys is stood behind a horse while this gunfight is going off, and then Holiday fires his shotgun into the air, causing the horse to rise, to buck. Why didn't the horse buck before with the gunshot? I watched it again and went, ooh, I'm not sure about that, if I'm honest. But
apparently, horses only buck when it's a shotgun.
Fair enough. Good to know. Well, next time I'm out in the country, it's fine.
Yeah, it's, you know. It's one of those well-known facts about horses.
Six from the shooters city, don't do yeah. nothing to them, but like shotguns, that's yeah. what really freaks them yeah. out.
Is it like in a horse manual?
Yeah.
You can wear a six shooter, but for God's sake, don't fire a shotgun around them. You'll be in a world of trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, the very famous horse western manual of, I forgot who wrote it. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Oh, dear.
So anyway, so they get all killed. Everybody kind of comes up, leaves, even the, they all leave basically Doc and Wyatt there. Or by themselves, and then we get to see the cowboy's funeral, where you know now something more is going to be happening because they're running by, or they're doing their parade, or whatever you call it, to the cemetery by Wyatt and Virgil and all of them. And
it's a good juxtaposition because the lawmen are sat out on the stoop, and it's almost like they're antagonizing them. Now the bit I got from this was, these cowboys have got a cheek. They're walking down the road with a sign that says "Murdered on the streets of Tombstone." Yeah. What? Are you serious?
It's a fair point, you know, to get morally offended, you know, like given all the stuff they've done, yeah, it's got some cheek.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, and that's another point where it's like you're supposed to feel. I don't know, like. Well, maybe the cowboys weren't fully, like, yeah, it was all circumstance and they all kind of, nobody deserves to die, but again, you're not necessarily feeling any certain way about them. Like, you're not feeling like, all those people died because of unfortunate circumstances and they shouldn't have. You're kind of like, well.
When you watch the old, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, westerns, there's no gray area. You are the good guy with the star, or you're the bad guy with the dusty hat, you know, the black hat, as it were. And there's no gray area. That's what you are. What Tombstone does with this is it paints the cowboys in a morally gray area where it shouldn't. But what he does brilliantly is it's moving the marshals and the sheriffs into that gray area where they shouldn't be, where they've gone and picked a fight with the cowboys that shouldn't have been a fight. They could have got them on something else. You know, they had to wait a couple of hours. They'd have done something else. And it's like, you guys are in the wrong here for the right reasons. And now you've sort of brought your morality into disrepute, into repute, because what you've done is morally wrong. You know, you went after them over something silly where you should have waited and took them down over something much larger. And I think that's talking about you guys, you know, you can take it apart a bit more and it makes a bit more sense of the film and how they piece that bit together. But straight watching it, you're going, it was a bit silly, wasn't it?
Yeah. But it does lead us to probably the most famous scene in the whole movie.
I think it is the most famous scene. Like, I do want to, before we get to saying that most famous line again, I do like Michael Biehn's performance as Johnny Ringo his little, like, monologue about, like, I want your blood, I want your soul, you know, like, the way he says
as he's drunk.
It's moustache twirling villain, but done for the 20th century then. Yeah, the 20th century. You know, he's like I say, he's wearing the black hat, moustache twirling, tying the ladies to the railway line. That's what he's doing. He's doing it in such a brilliant way because he's really sort of sadistic with it.
Yeah,
and you're a bit like, ooh, he's unhinged. That's what I like about him. And then he obviously meets his counter in Holiday.
Yeah. I mean, they're constantly referred to, Holiday himself kind of talks about, and, you know, even before that, they're just like each other. Mm. But I don't know, they're watching it this time, and I know, like, Ringo is one of the top spots, but I don't know, for some reason, I didn't realize how good he's, like, I would almost, like, I mean, obviously, Val Kilmer steals the show, he's the best part, like, no, hands down, but I'd almost put Ringo as a close second
I agree completely because Holiday works brilliantly, but if you've got no villain that's equal to him, it sort of diminishes that that persona a little bit. So you got Michael Biehn coming up to him in that same sort of, you know, raising his game to meet Val Kilmer's. Yeah. The pair of them are fantastic to be. I mean, we're talking about, I don't think there's a really mediocre performance throughout the whole film. They all do it well, apart from Charlton Heston, but we'll get to him.
Yeah, I don't think there's many, like, weak links in the cast. I think, as we've discussed, like, there's some actors who don't get a lot to do, you know, like any of the female actors, and also Jason Priestley, but like nobody's bad necessarily.
No.
It seems more script issue maybe than it is an acting issue. I don't know. Or a director. Perhaps. So Johnny Ringo, he wants after Wyatt, but no, because Wyatt's Holiday's friend, and because Doc Holliday has has nothing to lose, he says the famous "I'm your Huckleberry" about wanting to play a game, and they're going to until Curly Bill comes up, because I think it's kind of suggested that they don't want to cause any more trouble and get caught.
Yeah.
But then I think they know that, again, it's suggested by subtext or whatever, I always felt that they know that Doc can beat Ringo, I'd say, even at that point.
I think so. Because I counted it as well. I think, like, one of the kind of disappointing things, and I know, like, the historical records, they're playing that off that a little bit there, and the people who were actually at the OK Corral are the people that they've placed at the OK Corral and all kind of thing. But I did find it kind of disappointing that the fact that you've got Powers Booth chewing the scenery as Curly Bill, and you've got Michael Biehn chewing the scenery as Johnny Ringo. And I really enjoyed watching those characters so much. It is disappointing that you have this kind of bit in the movie where, like, Curly Bill kills the Town Marshal at about 52 minutes in, and then they both reappear here at, like, about an hour and 20. So you've got this big section and they're just not on the screen.
Well, even in all leading up to it, from the beginning opening scene, like, you're led to believe that Curly Bill is going to be kind of the big baddie in a way.
Yeah.
But he disappears and comes back and disappears and comes back, and then he dies he still dies at the end, but it's, you know, still early on comparatively to other characters.
I like the bit where he grabs hold of Doc Holliday and pulls him. He grabs hold of Johnny Ringo and pulls him. Yeah. Don't mind him; he's just drunk. I love that. Yeah. That's so well.
I love just after that when Johnny Ringo just knocks over a bunch of the coffins on his way back.
Oh, yeah, brilliant.
Oh, it's fun stuff.
Yeah. So after that is when we basically get into Wyatt has kind of been reluctant, or he's been, I don't know, he's kind of been the calm and collected one, and like, oh, well, we should handle this accordingly if we're going to even handle this. Mm. But after the events coming up is kind of where we start into gun shooting, horse riding montages.
Yes.
Which is all the assassination attempts.
It's all under the guise of a thunderstorm, isn't it? There's a storm coming, boys. There's a storm coming. I quite like that that allegory.
Yeah.
And so this is like the kind of cowboy's revenge. So we're kind of cutting between things. There is a literal storm going on, a thunder and lightning storm. Virgil's walking around town. We get that basically Josephine gets a tip off from County Sheriff Behan that shit's about to go down. So she tries to warn the wives of the Earps, and a shooter comes in and shoots them, and Virgil is obviously attacked, not seen on screen, then he wanders back into the bar. He's all bloody, and it's all generally kicking off in Tombstone.
And he will never have function in his arm, but it's not his good arm, so he can still hug his wife or whatever.
Yeah.
Then Morgan gets upset and goes out, and you think he's going to go find them, but instead he goes to play pool.
Angrily. He plays billiards angrily.
Which then gets him shot. And then, we get the scene.
So I think, like, I don't know, like, I want to ask you guys a question at this point, because, like, this is not Bill Paxton's fault. He's a great actor. I love him in most things he's in. And I think he's decent in this, but again, I think the character of Morgan is underwritten and, yes. He's just kind of there, you know, like Virgil and Wyatt are the main brothers and Morgan's just kind of the afterthought. And so when he gets shot in the back and it's supposed to be this big melodramatic moment, and they're supposed to try and heighten the melodrama with the slow-mo. And slow-mo can be done really well. You know, thinking of other Westerns, you know, something like The Wild Bunch, the slow-mo is done excellently. This, I think it just comes off cheesy, and it's just really the whole, I know it's like supposed to be this big emotional beat, and when like Kurt Russell is in the rain, he's like, Morgan! You know, it just comes off kind of, it doesn't really work for me. It just comes off melodramatic to me. It didn't hit me as yes. like a big emotional moment in the way I think the movie wants it to.
I agree with that, yeah, because it's, you know, these things are coming, and they're going for he's playing billiards, and gets shot playing billiards, and you knew it was coming somehow. I think if they'd have done the Hitchcock way of doing it, where you show the gun, you show the window, you show the angle of the, you know, of the shooter, and do some quick cuts between so you know it's coming, it probably would have heightened that scene a lot more. If not, it's just a man playing billiards, doing some decent acting, being shot in the back. That's what that scene is. There's no lead up to it, is that it just happens. It's kind of like Sam Elliott being shot off screen. It just happens.
Yeah.
You know, and it's sort of, like you say, it takes away the gravitas of the moment. That's what it does.
Yeah. I mean, because they put all of that. I mean, I agree with both of you. And I wrote in there, I wrote that it gets really melodramatic, you know, because they have the whole scene of them trying to get it out. And the whole purpose early on in a note, which I never actually said, I wrote that Bill Paxton is kind of underused. It's like his point there is to talk about, you know, he brings up God at some points, or he brings up the white light, and he has his, you know, kind of final line of saying, you know, that thing about the white light, I ain't seen shit, or whatever, however he phrases.
Yeah.
Or I don't see a damn thing.
That's
but,
it.
You know, it does feel like that was his only purpose in this movie, and so by doing that, we don't really feel it. And then we get the whole scene of them getting the bullet and shut the dog up. But then, yeah, it just, you see Kurt Russell in the rain sobbing and he's saying, get away, or whatever. And you're kind of like, oh, this is...
We have the scene there as well of a couple of the cowboys throwing their sashes in and saying, what they did to you women, we don't agree with that.
Yeah.
So they've found their point. That's it now. Is Michael Rooker as well. I mean, I think, like you say,
yeah.
Start of the film, you see that bride being taken into the chapel for an unpleasant time. And then, obviously, at this point, he's reached his limit. You know, it's all right shooting at lawmen and things like that, but I'm not dealing with any more of your saffness with shooting at women, unarmed women, you know.
Yeah.
It's I don't know, it's one of those scenes that it's there and it plays a part, but there's no emotional weight in it. Again, that's, you know, it's there to push the plot along.
Yeah. And, well, Bill Paxton also calls him... That's what it feels weird too, because he says, it's all about you, Wyatt, or something, you're the one, right before he dies. And it, I don't know, it just, the whole scene in general just kind of, it plays weird. But, but after that we get, so they're supposed to go, they say they're leaving and they're doing their parade, not parade, procession or whatever to take their dead brother, and they look upset and they're all leaving, and, which you don't, Wyatt and his wife haven't split up. She's there. And they're going, and Ringo says that thing where you smell that, it smells like a person died.
Yeah.
They're kind of chuckling or whatever. And they're going to Ike.
What a piece of shit.
Yeah. And the other one are going to basically finish him off at the train station.
Yeah. That scene you're talking about there where Johnny Ringo brings that up, I mean, that is straight lifted from Shane, that is. I don't know if you've seen Shane. That scene is straight lifted from that. There's the scene where Shane and the landowner walk past the people who are trying to take them off the land, and they've killed one of the sort of, like, it's too hard to explain, but they've killed somebody, and they walk past the crowd, and they do the same. They walk past these crowd of cowboys and they do exactly the same. They antagonize them. They try and, you know, run them out of town, as it were, while they're leaving town.
Yeah. But
also in that scene, I do like Powers Booth, just because it's the laconic way that after Kurt Russell has told him that he's leaving town, Powers Booth just goes, "Well, bye," and that's it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they get on the train, they're about to kill him, and then they get word, and they turn around, and one of them is shot, and then Ike instantly drops his gun and starts, and that's where...
That's where Wayne comes in again.
Yeah, yeah, well, I was just in the background going, "Oh, piece of shit."
Yeah. And he's basically a coward, and he gets his face slashed by Wyatt Spur, and Wyatt tells him to run and tell all of them that if he sees a red sash, he's coming for him, and tell him he's all hell's coming, or basically the very beginning of the man with no name, Pale Horse. He's fulfilling that prophecy because he's the one.
This is my favorite bit of acting from Kurt Russell in the movie, because he goes so pro wrestling here. Yeah. Like when he says the line, "You called down the thunder and now you got it." It's like, oh,
it's brilliant.
I was like, ah, oh, Kurt's cutting a promo. It's great.
Yeah. Well, that even, it goes into the scene when, so we get the riding montage of them just killing men and,
yeah,
you know, riding horses.
My note says montage of cowboy genocide.
Yeah,
yeah, then, I've just put montage of riding and killing. It's like, yeah, because at this point in the movie, you know, like previously we've had these attempts at like kind of giving the violence weight, but the violence is given like no weight here, and like you're just watching it and you're like, well, I guess these guys are bad.
Well, some of them, it's like, you know, you see how many are getting shot and they're like just sitting in a bar and they crash through the door, or when they crash through the wall on a horse and shoot them, or some of them are just laying in bed.
Like, yeah. And they do not attempt to arrest anybody. They're just like, nah, fuck you guy.
Yeah.
Wild West Death Squad.
Yeah. And then we get to the scene where I think of it like with kids, where if you're playing like action, whatever, make believe with a child, or and you are, and there's like the kid that's like, "No, you didn't shoot me." That's what it feels like with this scene where Kurt Russell is just yelling "No" and walking across the river, and he kills, and like Curly Bill's shooting at him but can't hit him, and he's going "No," and he's blasted. Somehow he's killing everybody.
The weirdest thing about that is, right, so doing the research, there is a historical account of, you know, and again, like, all these kind of myth-building things that happen around all these kind of figures, you don't know how accurate all these historical accounts are, but there was a historical source that said that Wyatt Earp, like, walked across the water facing down all these bullets and killed Curly Bill. Like, that's... Okay. A thing that happened, apparently.
Which I know, it pops up in, I know it's the Coen Brothers True Grit, they mentioned it as well, of that, Jeff Bridges, he talks about charging, that you do the charge directly at them or something. I forgot the whole lines, but they get so, if you're charging directly at them firing, they get so freaked out about it, and because of whatever, that you almost have a better chance. I don't know how I mean, obviously the Coen brothers phrase it a lot better than I am right now, so I wonder if that was taken from those accounts too.
Possibly.
Like if you have that kind of madness in you, or that like no fear of death, if you almost, you frighten them more so that they're more likely to miss.
Yeah.
No, I've never stared down a gun down in
town. Yeah, me neither.
No, neither have I. So I have no,
I'll take your word for it, Craig.
No point of reference here. So,
I don't think any of us are going to be in one of those positions, but that I'll just true. Yeah, go off of the True Grit. Whatever Jeff Bridges says, I'm like, okay, yeah, why not?
Yeah. We'll take Jeff Bridges' word for it.
Yeah.
And, again, maybe we're kind of following the history a little bit. They're kind of, they're really strictly following the history in some ways and not following the history at all in other ways. Yeah. It's, again, it's kind of weird, but it's fair. But cinematically, it does feel weird that Curly Bill kind of dies here.
Yes.
I suppose that really there's no out and out sort of top boss, is there? No. Throughout the entire film, you sort of go from, you know, Ike, piece of shit, to Thomas Hayden Church at OK Corral, to Curly Bill, to Johnny Ringo. You know, it sort of passes between whoever's in the vicinity doing something wrong at the time.
Yeah. And
under the guise of Curly Bill being the top dog, but it's a cowboy gang. So it's not like Eli Wallach's character in the Magnificent Seven, he's the top dog. You can see that he is the man that pulls all the strings.
Yeah,
it's okay. Not sort of that sort of thing. It's sort of like, yeah, he's the top guy, but these other guys do what they're all independent of him. So yeah, it's a weird one because there's no out and out big bad. Like, you know, as you guys have watched all those Seagal films, there's always a big bad in that. Yeah. It's like an arcade game. You start with a little fry and work your way up to the top.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, where in this, it's moving in and about. You could kill, like, a third in command 10 minutes into the film. You know, it feels like that sort of film, doesn't it?
Then
we get, I don't know, because it is interesting, like you were saying, Wayne, with the whole... It feels, and especially with the script and so much cut out of it, I wonder if it's something that would have, by today's standards, almost have been more of like a miniseries or what would have, you know, something like Deadwood, where it was just like, here is the account from the timeline from beginning to.
Yeah.
And because even there's a point at the OK Corral where he tells the sheriff that he's not going to arrest them today. Whatever, and there's that moment. I wrote down. I didn't mention it. That, like, oh, the movie could have just ended right here, almost.
Yeah, it could
and,
have.
Yeah, but they just, it keeps going of kind of telling these accounts. But yeah, and then we get Jason Presley kind of having his big moment that doesn't mean anything and is undeserved because Billy Zane, who again, we haven't really had too many scenes with or anything or. Again, all this stuff. He's just
He pops up dead. Like twice before his death. Yeah. That's he doesn't have much of a role in it at all. Because I am a wrestling fan, I did put in my notes: Priestley turns face after death of Zane.
Yeah. Well, and there's the monologue about him wanting to bring something of beauty. He was beautiful, and he was trying to bring some beauty into your horrible world or whatever, and. Yeah, again, like, oh, yeah, that guy who we saw an hour ago. Okay.
it's Henry V is still emblazoned in all our minds.
That's it. The bit I didn't get here is, so after Curly Bill's, no, just before that, isn't it? All these cowboys have been sworn as marshals, haven't they?
Yeah.
Yes, by the
sheriff, isn't it? It's got to be by, I forgot the sheriff's name. What's the sheriff's name?
Behan.
Yeah, piece of shit. That's the one. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you see them charging at them, or not charge. I don't know. There's that scene where they look through the telescope and see the whole group riding their way. And then you just never, they don't deal with that again. That's when they run over to, Charlton Heston's house or something.
Doc Holliday gets, worse, doesn't he? Cause he's been riding with them and his tuberculosis is getting the better of him. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, because of, I guess, coincidence, she shows up as well at the ranch, at Charlton Heston's ranch.
I've just put in my notes here, more of the hokey romance.
Yeah. And, yeah, I know you were saying, Wayne, you wanted to talk more about Heston.
The acting piece of wood, absolutely. I'm assuming that you say there's an hour and 30 minutes on the floor. I'm assuming that the 15 minutes of that is Charlton Heston delivering one of his lines. Because it sounds anybody could have played. You know, like he plays that moment in Wayne's World where.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's done for laughs and it's like, oh, he's got a bit of dramatic gravitas. In this, I think he forgets that he can actually dramatically act because it's like anybody could have played this role. Yeah. Anybody. Mm-hmm. Give it to somebody who cares. It's like. I almost feel like it's, I've got this gig, I'm going and acting in this new, Kurt Russell, Val Kilmer film about Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday. Are you really? I'll call wait. He gets there and he's got two lines of script and he's like, fuck this, I'm just cashing the paycheck. Yeah. Whatever. You know, oh yeah, we'll look after him. Sorry, I could have done it. Just, you know, age me up a bit, stick me on stage. I could have done it. No worries. And the two vintage actors in this are a bit strange to me. So you get Charlton Heston and Robert Mitchum. Neither of them have a massive background in Wild West films. It's like, well, we just need somebody from old Hollywood. Who have we got? Well, let's get these two guys. One of them did like sci-fi films and some epic biblical films. And the other did loads of film noir. So let's get them into this historical Western. It makes no sense. Yeah,
it is kind of funny because, like, I was kind of thinking that as well. It was like, you know, you were saying earlier, Wayne, you know, when you think Val Kilmer, what film do you think of?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, this film would be near the top of the list. And it's like, when I think Charlton Heston, I think, like, Ten Commandments. Yeah. You know, when I think Robert Mitchum, I think, like, Night of the Hunter. And
those great Western films.
Well, it would have been great for, they should have got, I don't know, there's, like, as you were talking about, Wayne, like, there's Rory Calhoun, there's, who is alive, you know, I know that he was alive during that time. There's all these kind of different,
tons of different actors
who were still alive before then.
Exactly. There's, I'm just trying to think, you got Eli Wallach was still alive at this point. Yeah. You could have got him to come and deliver these lines. I'm trying to think. I mean, at a push, I suppose you could have tried for Clint if you really wanted some gravitas to your film. I don't think Clint would have done it off the back of, you know, a year off the back of Unforgiven. But you got people who have got a history of Wild West films. So why go and pick these two? It's a bit... And it almost feels like they're playing it of, oh, these guys, you know, back in the day, they were in Hollywood films. It's like, yeah, but they weren't in Westerns.
Yeah.
I don't know what they're doing in this other than being, you know, an acting block of wood. At one point, I did actually think, why have they put that beam in the middle of the door? And it was Charlton Heston, so.
No, he's not Grant. It's a totally throwaway cameo. It's just there. But the plot continues as McMaster, who's played by Michael Rooker, is dead. He's just thrown down. His dead body is kind of thrown at them at the ranch, and they're kind of one of Ringo's guys delivers a message to Wyatt that, like, meet him at, I think it's like Oak Hill or something. He wants to face mano a mano for a gun duel, and he accepts. But not before talking to Doc about it.
Which Doc gives the whole, he wants revenge for being born. That's the type of man Ringo is. And that, Wyatt knows he can't beat Ringo. And Doc even confirms it of saying he won't beat Ringo.
Nothing like your friends to back you up, is there?
Yeah. But Doc has other plans because he asks about, what's it like wearing that badge? And, you know, he's doing all that.
Yeah.
Which you're like, oh, well, he's on his deathbed. And so I'll just give him this badge. But no, Doc still has a few tricks up his sleeve because they ride out, they meet the gang, and they basically say, well, Ringo's just down the path, which Wyatt treks alone. But then we assume that, walking up to Ringo, and Ringo assumes too that it is Wyatt Earp, but no, it is Doc Holliday.
Dun, dun, dun.
The others. Yeah. So basically the two most famous scenes in this movie are between Ringo and Val Kilmer, Ringo and Doc Holliday, because he says he does again the I'm your Huckleberry. And then you can see the fear in Ringo's eyes. And he's like, well, I don't want to. He's kind of stuttering of like, this isn't with you, Doc. He's like, no, we have a game we started a long time ago for blood.
It's really well done that.
Yeah, it's an excellently done scene, this one.
Yeah. Again, historically accurate. They're about 3 feet apart from each other. And they're just sort of circling each other. It almost looks like they're about to bullfight each other, doesn't it? It's really well handled.
Yeah,
for sure.
I just love, so finally, you know, Doc is coffin and he's all calm like he has been the whole time. And once they shoot and he gets him in the head and you see Ringo doing that like weird, you know, because he's been shot in the head, that dance thing of like he's firing the gun and Doc is just yelling, come on. And then he even insults him. He's like, oh, you, I forgot. What does he say now? It's like, you were just, don't have it. I forgot to write it down. Or he's yelling, come on, and he's...
Yeah, I remember the come on, come on, and he's kind of dancing around him, but I can't when he lies down and he kind of cradles him. Like, I can't remember
what he says. Is it something like, you even die poorly, or something like that?
Yeah, it's basically saying he was just all... in some way, it's like, oh, you're just all show. You're just... like, I don't know, something like... I can't remember. I'll remember it when we... stop yes. filming.
Basically, it was a suggestion that he was all talk all along.
Yeah. But no, that's that is kind of one of those, it's one of those moments where it oddly makes the movie. Like, all the problems you have with it, like, their scenes together. Like, if you just had a movie that was Doc Holliday and Ringo and this, you know, kind of showing the struggle leading up to it, I mean, I'd watch the hell out of that.
Yeah. And then, well, after that duel, that well done duel, and next in my notes, I've just put more riding and killing. Yeah. We get another montage of just indiscriminate killing of people who we are, as the audience, presume are evil people and need to be wiped out the world.
Yeah.
And Wayne's favorite guy.
Oh, Stephen Lang, you piece of shit.
He doesn't even die. He just throws his sash off.
Exactly. He rips the sash off in this sort of like, and doing that high pitched thing he does. Yeah. So it's the last charge of Viatope and his immortals. And you're like, he's going to get him. He's going to, he rips it off and he puts the gun away. No, just pretend you're still holding it and put a bullet in your brain. That's all a favor. Yeah. But no.
They could, it was back then, you didn't have anything. They could have just done it, but they just hold on to that honor code of like, well, it's off. I guess he's going to do some more horrible stuff, but it's not our problem anymore.
No. Yeah.
But yeah, that kind of leads us to the Doc and Wyatt final scene. So, you know, we've seen Doc basically laying sick in bed, recurring throughout, but this is the final
This is his actual deathbed.
Yeah.
Wyatt walks in just after he's received last rites, isn't he? Yeah. And it's like, I don't think Doc Holliday is a religious man, but fuck it, he'll take it anyway.
Yeah. Well, Doc even makes the comments about it, saying, like, oh, we were just talking about the mysteries of the Catholic Church or something, and then saying, my hypocrisy knows no bounds. But then Wyatt says, I don't think you're a hypocritical man. I think you just... like to pretend to be or something. And yeah, this kind of has it's this weirdly sentimental moment that I think works better than the Rain melodrama scene.
Oh, yeah. I think this works way better. I do feel the emotion of this scene. I know, like, when, like, Doc Holliday is saying, you know, like, live every second, live life up to the hilt, live for me. Like, I did feel the emotion of that. Yeah. I do feel like this scene has appropriate weight.
Yeah, of him saying, if you're my friend, then the best thing you can do right now is just go. Because that's what, you know, and all this stuff. And, you know, that part actually is kind of like what it gets you, it choked up. And you see, because as you were saying, Wayne, like throughout it, you're watching him kind of deteriorate and he's getting more and more pale. And this is just, even by this end, you see the sweat and how pale he is. And it's
going back to Val Kilmer's acting again.
Yeah.
Not only is he smashing all these fantastic lines and doing all of that brilliant, you know, dragging your eye to him, he's also having to deal with trying to pretend that he's got tuberculosis.
Yeah.
You know, and he's doing all of that. He's completely convincing as a character.
Well, in this scene, like, reading about the behind the scenes, like, he went pretty method. He's not doing that much acting. So in this scene, he is he's on a bed of ice to try... because he wanted to experience something as close to the experience of dying as possible. So yeah, he's going pretty hardcore method in this one.
Oh jeez,
wow,
that's actors. Crazy. Yeah,
Jesus.
Well, I know. Yeah, you know, speaking of the doors, that was another thing is that he went like full method. with Jim Morrison for the Doors one. I don't remember.
Yes,
he did
yes,
a bunch of stuff that went way overboard.
Yeah. That kind of sickly pallor is not just all makeup.
Okay.
It's literally freezing his ass off. Wow.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this scene, I think it kind of, for the sake of this movie and what we've witnessed between him and Doc, I think it kind of is a nice kind of wrap up. And you could almost even end there, but he brings them the book that he wrote about. It's like My Friend, Doc Holliday. And then
would have been the perfect ending scene. Like, I definitely feel like you could have ended the movie here.
Yeah. I agree completely. And you even have, which I think it suggested kind of that Doc Holliday sees a light or something, because he's like, as he's dying, he says, it's like a little joke to himself of like, oh damn, or whatever. There's some sort of, I don't know, something that is going on in his head that is supposed to harken back.
I took it as sort of, it's an old saying, isn't it? When you die, your toes curl.
Oh yeah.
And he's looking at his feet, isn't he? But he's never mentioned it in the film once.
Yeah.
To piece that together. So I'm feel like I'm just barking up the wrong tree completely.
You could be right though. Yeah. Like, I think that's a good show.
It's the strange one that is.
Yeah. But no, we don't get that as a great ending. We get him going to see, her, and then, to let it be known that he doesn't have a lot of money, but she's like, don't worry, my family's rich. And then they decide to dance.
So this scene annoys me because I've written in my notes, right? That romance we all care about is finally consummated. And then I've put capitalism wins because it's just like, that's okay. My family's rich. And it's like, oh, that's convenient to the plot. I don't.
So they dance in the snow and then we get just more exposition. Robert Mitchum telling kind of what happened after the fact.
Was it Randolph Scott cried at, no, he's not Randolph Scott, is it? But somebody cried at Wyatt's funeral. So he lived to a grand old age because films were being made when he died. So
he died in 1929. Apparently, a bunch of the early cowboy actors and John Ford and a bunch of Hollywood people knew the actual real Wyatt Earp.
Wow, that's incredible.
We learned that Ike was killed at a bank robber, or he tried to rob a bank or something a couple of years later, and he was killed.
Good night, Stephen Lang, you utter piece of shit.
But that ending, I don't know. Because it's like you have such a powerful scene with Doc Holliday, and I just, especially watching it this time, I hated that ending. I just felt so, I was like, oh, come on, why are you doing this to me? But
I think it's made more cheesy by the fact it's at Christmas as well. It just reminds me of Christmas and they're dancing in the snow. It's just like, this just feels unnecessary.
I think they didn't want, because the film is quite, it's back and forth, and as we've stated, it's morally ambiguous. But you get to the end, and if you end it where, there's no two ways about it now, if this film was made in 2021, that would be your ending, where Doc Holliday dies, that would be your ending. And you get Robert Mitchum come over and talk over the credits and whatnot, as you see black and white images of Wyatt Earp and all the rest of them, that's what it'd be. But because I think they were like, this film is really dour and we need to have Wyatt Earp have a happy ending and we need some, semblance of happiness in the world. It's not all doom and gloom. I think that's why they shoehorned it in. It's not needed at all. Mm. It's just there to give Wyatt and Josephine this happy ending. They could have set it up earlier in the film for them to be together, but it's sort of like, we just need it to be. So there is life in the world afterwards. It's not all gunshots and dead cowboys.
Yeah. No, it makes sense, I think, especially, as we've kind of all said, I know, Scott, you were saying in the very beginning of, like, making it more of more of a theater movie, for all audiences. Where it's like, you have the love story, you have the whatever. So it appeals to everybody.
I think so. I think so for sure. And Yeah, the movie kind of goes back and forth on how morally ambiguous it wants to be. It goes back and forth on how much weight it wants to give to the violence. It goes back and forth of whether how serious a movie it is or how popcorny a movie it is. It's very confused a lot of the time, but it is an entertaining watch in the end.
It is a very entertaining. I had at no point during this film that I look at the time or think, oh, you know, better get off to bed or whatever. It was like, yeah, I'm glued to this. I'm enjoying it. It's a good Western.
And you know, for and not every movie that is, this movie is 130 minutes. You know, like some movies that are that length really, really drag. And this movie doesn't. It romps along for its 130 minutes, flaws and all. So. We have talked fully about the movie. We've covered all of the movie. But before we head on out, do either of you want to give any kind of final thoughts that you've got on Tombstone? We'll go to you first, Wayne.
Yeah, sure. So, Stephen Lang isn't a piece of shit. He's a remarkable actor who I think portrays Ike fantastically to the point where I think Ike is a massive piece of shit, and it's so well done by Stephen Lang. It's obviously just for a comedic effect, but yeah, Stephen Lang does this character, infinite douchebaggy justice, and he, for me, is one of the all-time douchebag characters in any film possible. He's just an absolute twat. So yeah, that's my entire final thought, really, to be honest.
Excellent, excellent. You're entirely correct. He plays a genuinely infuriating shitheel coward super well.
Yeah.
Craig, final thoughts?
No, I think, like, as I said before, I think there are some issues you could see, obviously. The script had a lot cut, especially when you're analyzing it like this, or we're going scene by scene, but it is, you know, it's a fun watch. I can understand why it's a classic. And again, as we've talked about, everybody does a good job with what they're given. And I mean, you watch it mainly for, as we've said many times, I usually recommend it for anybody to watch it just for the sake of, you know, Val Kilmer and, I lost track of his name, Michael Bain. And I mean, for that alone, I'd recommend watching at least once, but yeah, it definitely has some issues that make it a little more older and outdated than it could have been in 2021.
So that is just our thoughts on Tombstone. Please do come in with your comments, with your reviews. Tell us what you think about Tombstone. Tell us what you think we got right, what you think we got wrong. If you think we were misguided on some things, whatever it is, just give us your feedback. That'd be cool. But before we head on out, I just want to ask Wayne, tell our audience where they can find your podcast. Tell us where we can find you on social media. Give promote away, my man.
Right, okay. So I am from the £1 Movie Podcast. It's a podcast where I search for films that cost one British pound or less. Oh. Could be anything. Could be Oscar winners. Could be B-movie trash. And you can find me on Twitter, Facebook. On Twitter, it's at £1 Movie. I'm at £1 Movie Podcast. On Facebook, just put £1 Movie Podcast into Facebook. You can find me on Spotify, Deezer. I'm not many places, to be honest. I haven't promoted the podcast as hard as I should have. As I was saying to Craig off air, this is a side project from another podcast I do. So, which is the You Haven't Heard This Music podcast, which is all about unheard music and little heard bands and artists. So you can find me on both of those. Please like, subscribe, all that jazz. You know what to do.
And talking about knowing what to do, Craig, give us the regular plugs.
Oh, yep. I also co-host the podcast Bloodhound Picks, which we will either highlight basically indie or obscure artists or older films from within the horror community. And yeah, recently we just did a couple horror comics too, because people reached out to us for that, which should be coming up, I think, this month or next, depending on when it's that specific.
Like remember, this is the Kurt Russell season, Craig. Yes. So this is now September.
Oh, yep. Never mind that. So you will have already heard them if you decide to listen to it. But besides that, yeah, just Craig Dram on Twitter or Instagram or any of those, or Bloodhound Picks, which is PIX on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all the social media things, as always.
And if you want to check out my other podcast, you can. It's New Horror Express. Talk to indie horror movie directors and sometimes actors and sometimes novelists. And we do something kind of similar to this where we cover guilty pleasure horror movies once a month as well. But in terms of this podcast, you can always hit us up on our Twitter at 90s_all. And you can check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, a bunch of other places where you can get your podcasts. Please do rate, review, and subscribe to us. And if you do review us, please, please, please give us 5 stars, because otherwise the algorithm will tell us we are terrible. And we don't think we're terrible. So 5 stars or nothing, folks. That's what we got. Anyway, we gotta head on out now, and join us again next week when we will be covering Stargate. Until then, though, see ya!